Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
Sioux Falls, South Dakota. That mean anything to you? Didn't to me, at least not until 2 weeks ago. In fact, I would have had a hard time differentiating Sioux Falls from Sioux City, Iowa. Now, what if I told you that Sioux Falls is at the center of the global economy? Get ready for our partnership with the Atlantic Magazine and the mapping technology company Esri from American Public Media. This is Marketplace American Futures, the podcast.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. In this podcast, we are going to introduce you to the main characters in our American Futures project and give you a sense of the technology and the concept behind it. The whole kit and caboodle is really just a collaboration building on America's history of serial journalism. That tradition we have of discovering things about the country and ourselves one small city at a time. Only this time by air in a small airplane owned and flown by the Atlantic's Jim Fallows. Jim has started out on the road. He's in Holland, Michigan. Jim, it's a great pleasure to have you with us.
Hello, Kai. Nice to talk to you.
I want to start and throw to you with a question that you put in your very first post on this trip about Holland, Michigan on the Atlantic website. Why and why here? Why do you find yourself in Holland?
Well, this is the beginning of a trip we're going to be doing, trying to go to smaller towns in America that have interesting economic stories, technological stories, stories of demographic adjustment, parts of the American saga that are often left out of our normal news coverage. I usually live in Washington, D.C., so this is a change. And so Holland we've started with because of its unusual industrial story.
Tell me a little bit more about that. I mean, there's lots there that I think people might not know.
Right. Well, Holland is a place that I think is known in Michigan, but not necessarily worldwide. And when it is known worldwide, it's for its almost ye olde curiosity shop type Dutch aspects. But it also has been for a long time the center of real manufacturing clusters. There was a long time a shipbuilding industry here. It's on a small lake that connects to Lake Michigan. That's become now an industry making turbine blades for these giant windmills you see around the country. Most of the world's office furniture is made in the immediate radius of Holland from Herman Miller or Hayworth or Steelcase. So at a time when we wonder whether manufacturing is viable in America, in the Rust Belt, in the upper Midwest, et cetera, this is a place that has a lot of it right here.
You're talking to a public radio audience here, Jim. I think everybody out there knows Herman Miller in the Aeron chair, right?
Yes. Some of the big hotels here in Holland, they have dual sets of both Herman Miller and Hayworth furniture so that when delegations are coming in from one company or another, they can swap out the sets for an appropriate feel.
That's perfect. What are you hearing from people in Holland as you go about the city and ask them these questions that you have in mind as you start this trip? What do they want you to know?
What is so interesting is that what's an urgent question in most of the country, which is how are we going to get the economy going again, less urgent here. I mean, obviously, unemployment is a problem here, as it is any place, but there are these very big, very successful, and very relatively stable locally based businesses. And so instead, two of the main things that have come up just in these past few days we've been here is, number one, the ongoing effects, both good and complicating, of demographic change. There's a very large migrant worker population here, mainly Latino, that comes for the agricultural works, blueberry picking, the world's largest pickle plant, et cetera. And so the effects of ethnic change on school systems, on social order or whatever, that's one thing that is you wouldn't expect to be the case in a town called Holland, Michigan, but is. The other is some very interesting recent debates on gay rights.
Part of the reason this trip stands out and part of the reason it works, I guess, is because you're doing it by air. You're doing it in your own plane. Tell us about that.
The plane is a Cirrus SR-22, which is made by the Cirrus Aircraft Company of Duluth, Minnesota, a place we plan to go to. The most famous aspect of this plane to the general public is the fact that it has a parachute for the entire plane, so that if you get in some kind of trouble, as you know, I'll explain where going to try to avoid that. There's a red handle you pull, and a parachute comes out, and the whole plane drifts survivably to the ground. The main watchword we're having for this trip is to do no difficult flying. We want the flying to be the most routine part of it, only in good weather, only relatively short hops, only in daytime, because you can get into a lot of trouble in small planes, as people know. So we're sticking to the safe, even boring part of flying, although it's never boring to see the world from a 2,000-foot elevation.
Jim's going to be blogging on our site and at The Atlantic about his journeys. But as part of the reporting, he's also going to be focusing on the geography of these cities, the landscapes and the terrain. But geography can also be cultural and social, looking at the demographics and populations of different areas. And to report that out for this project, we're working with a mapping technology company, Esri. It builds mapping software that your local or state government almost certainly uses. The maps help plan for weather or traffic or any sort of event. It can also help businesses grow and track economics and population trends. One of the instigators of our relationship with Esri was Jim Fallows himself, because he grew up with the CEO of the company, a guy named Jack Dangermond. Mr. Dangermond joins us now from his company headquarters out in Redlands, California, to talk about the project and what his company does. Mr. Dangermond, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
This is going to sound like a kind of a basic question for a guy who runs a company that you run, but when you look at a map, what do you see?
Usually I see I'm always hunting for a story. What is the map trying to tell me? And the stories about maps range from, simple things like, where am I? How do I get there? What kind of elevation are we at? That sort of thing. Let's just say descriptive sorts of stories, context stories, to analytic maps which say, this is the best place to locate a store, or this is the worst place, or this is a hot spot for biodiversity, or this is where the disease is spreading. These are stories, and good cartographers actually can craft good stories using mapping as a kind of storytelling framework. Behind these maps is not just raw measurements. Well, in some cases, it is just raw measurements, like a GPS location or raw measurements of elevation or where the roads are. But often behind these more analytic maps are lots of layers of data which can be manipulated or analyzed to come up with an answer, like where should I locate a store, or where should I locate a fire station or a public health clinic, that sort of thing. So stories, that's it.
You have called yourself, I think I get this right, you have called yourself a landscape engineer, right? You're looking more at landscape and terrain than, directions when you're looking for a map.
Yeah, exactly. I was a landscape architect by training and have a few degrees in that. The concept there was not simply landscape is an adjective or adverb like landscaping, but understanding the landscape like a geographer would. So landscape architecture, which is the right term, is about designing landscapes for people like in parks or in open space planning or land use planning. It's bringing together a lot of the scientific layers of information and also what people need and want, and designing interesting landscapes. And that profession is used in a lot of different fields, actually.
Well, explain that a little bit, because it's it's your company that's helped make it possible to have those professions and to apply it in real life.
Well, landscape architecture itself wasn't just my company. It was really... It has its origins over 100 years ago with people like Frederick Law Olmsted, who designed Central Park and a lot of the great parks in the United States. He envisioned this idea of creation or designing landscapes and used plants and topography as a way to do it. When I got into the field as a young student, we used plastic overlays of maps to try to synthesize landscape processes like and interpret these processes. If you took layers of where the floodplains are and where there's steep slopes or unstable geology and added them to where the people are and cultural characteristics, and you overlaid them like plastic overlays, then you could kind of see some patterns and relationships in geography. And then design appropriately, design with nature or design with the grain of what nature is telling us or what geography is telling us. So I got interested in computers because, those plastic overlays weren't very good. And at the time, what was emerging is quantitative analysis in a lot of fields. So at Harvard, I worked in a research lab that invented some of the first computer mapping tools. But behind those mapping tools, it wasn't just about visualization. Behind those mapping tools were analytic tools that would overlay these like plastic overlay equivalents in digital environments and allow us to interpret information. And it turns out that, in fact, many, many institutions in our society need to do this geographic approach for planning. And it comes to, like, where do I buy real estate in the commercial sector or in the government sector, planning the best place for certain kinds of activities or what areas should be conserved in conservation.
It even gets to Starbucks is a client of yours, right? I mean, where to put a coffee
Starbucks
shop?
Starbucks is a huge client, so they use it for locating their facilities, and there are hundreds of retailers that do that, from big box companies down to small realtors. Historically, this technology was pretty complicated. When we started out, I guess it was over four decades ago, we used mainframe computers, and the maps were not very good. But very gradually, as computing got better, our mapping was able to get better, and also, more importantly, the analytics behind the maps got better. So today, most people are familiar with things like Google Maps or Bing Maps.
Yeah,
you know, they keep us from getting lost. So computer maps are very popular these days for consumers. GPS, which is now embedded in most you know, devices that we use, is also very popular. So the combination of those two things keep people from getting lost or they help them navigate. That's one end of the spectrum of my world. The other end of the spectrum means that means being able to overlay all this information and analyze it and support better decision making. So we have now hundreds of thousands of organizations who use our tools, but they're not so consumer focused, although some of them make consumer looking facing maps. They're about analyzing their geographic information inside the enterprise and helping them make their organizations better, whether that's in the public sector or in the business or in research, frankly. It's all about geography and being able to model it and see it as maps. So maps, actually, back to your first question, are interesting ways to tell stories. They communicate about things. And what's emerging with this new generation of web computing is web GIS, or our field, we call it GIS, Geographic Information Systems. Web GIS is becoming very easy to use by everybody, not simply consumers, but not simply analysts, but everybody that works inside of organizations. And that's where our software really plays very heavily.
You know, it's funny. It occurs to me that we are now, and the, you know, the buzzword out there when you're talking about things online and digital technology, it's all about big data, how much companies know about us and how much data is out there about consumers. But you really have been in the big data field for 40 years. I mean, these maps you build are about big data.
That's actually just exactly right. If we abstract geography, the science of our world, computationally, we in other words, turn geography and all of its processes and wonderful dimensions into digital bits, then we can analyze that information and see it as a map. But for me and most of my users, what is interesting is not necessarily simply the map. It's the ability to integrate information. So GIS is fundamentally the only technology with a focus on integration. It integrates all the different disciplines, all the different ologies like geology and sociology and all of them, ecology. So, and brings them together in a beautiful visual language that lets people understand their world. So people often ask me, what business are you in? Sometimes I'll say, I'm in the understanding business and building software tools that allow people to create understanding of their own organizations or their own interests or their own missions.
Okay, then roll with me on this one. Since data is, in theory, ever expanding, can a map, whether it's something you build or something Google Maps builds, can it ever really be done? It's always an iterative process, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. maps, or sorry, our geography can be looked at many different scales. So I've seen maps made of anthills, and they're in great detail. And then there's also maps of the entire world. So one of the dimensions that we manage is scalability of geographic information.
Yeah.
Also, increasingly, geographic information is becoming real time. So consumers are now used to the idea of traffic maps, and that's really real-time measurement through GPS and other devices, and you can now connect to that real-time feed and see things spatially, geographically. So my theory, and I've been saying this for many years, it's starting to actually become real, is that we are headed towards a time where virtually everything that changes or moves, I guess move is a change, will be measured. And second, made available via the web. So we're moving to a kind of living planet. And this kind of systematic geographic measurement and feeding it up through networks will ultimately become a kind of nervous system of our planet. So it gives us understanding of what's going on, just like our nervous system does. It allows us to see it visually, which is somehow through maps very intuitive. And it also will increasingly become integrated into the way people make decisions. So people make decisions by thinking about alternatives. They sketch out three alternatives to get to work, and they pick one and do it, and there's consequences to that. When they're designing a city, they sketch out alternative designs for a city, and they understand the consequences of that quantitatively, increasingly quantitatively, like the impacts will be this, or the it'll be a more beautiful city, or it'll be a more efficient city, or it'll be whatever. So as this nervous system becomes more and more integrated into society, people will do what I call geodesign. They will design alternatives and understand the consequences of these alternatives through modeling and real-time information. Some of these will be short-term kinds of geodesign decision-making, like personal decision-making, but all the big decisions about where land will be developed, what areas we will conserve, where we should go after oil, where should we mine, where should we locate facilities, pipelines, et cetera, all of those kinds of decisions are fundamentally geographic and need geographic information systems to be able to support rational ways to improve the decision. And that's, you know, Kai, that's fundamentally the reason why I'm so excited about the technology. I mean, I always, from a student on, is what excited me was this notion of bringing rational and scientific thinking to the way that people actually make decisions. And that flattens a lot of the political stuff. It really is grounded in something I think very human, which is the desire for rational decision making.
I get that, and I agree with you to some extent. And the technology that your company offers is a great way for us and Jim Fallows in this project to tell a story. But I can't help but wonder whether that analogy used of the nervous system and how it's just gonna how all this data and how we use it in decision-making processes. I can't decide whether it's thrilling and interesting or a little bit scary.
Well, for me, it's thrilling and interesting. And it also has to be balanced with the safeguards, public policy safeguards of things like open data, transparency, all of those things. In President Obama's early in their administration, when they provided this $760 billion of stimulus funding, he chose to be able to make that information about where they were going to spend that money available on maps. They're kind of an early version of what Jim is doing with story maps.
Right.
And so if you go to recovery.gov, you can zoom on into dots on maps and touch them, and it opens up information about where the government is spending money. And I thought that was just fantastic. It was another chapter in democracy, in my view. Maybe that's overstretching it, but it was the idea that every citizen could understand where their government was spending money, and they could check it out. They said, well, is this a project that is where the money is going to the brother-in-law of the, you know, the mayor or something, or is this a rational decision? Governor O'Malley took that further, where he's, for the state of Maryland, he's a governor back there. He has articulated both where he's spending money in transportation and healthcare and education, but also where the need is greatest. Where are we improving grade scores, or where do we need to? And then side by side, where are we putting the investment? So maps become a new medium. And what excites me about Jim's work is he's got this notion of geojournalism, the idea that maps can become a critical element in the communication to people. So he's doing geoblogging, for example, where he's actually telling stories as he's moving around. So I think we're only at the beginning of where this technology will go in society. And I think to answer your fundamental question, I think it needs to be, we need to ensure that it's open and not just the safeguard of one organization which can open it up or shut it down. But in my view, the nervous system of the planet is not just one organization. These tools allow thousands, hundreds of thousands of organizations to share their maps and their information, kind of like a library where I can cruise around the planet, zoom on to a particular location and see all the different overlays of things like property or pollution or health information about that location. So I believe in an open geospatial enabled information world, not dominated by just one organization or like that. And so I see this nervous system as one where there's going to be built into it a kind of checks and balances. It'll be an infrastructure, much like the phone system is an infrastructure or the electricity is an infrastructure. It'll be an information infrastructure which is organized geospatially and viewable through maps. Maps, you look at a story and you immediately get it in a map, whereas text or just tabular data, it's harder to understand.
Let me call you on that one for a second, because I love to look at maps, and I think it's cool, and context is everything, and that's what maps give you. But not all maps are intuitive. Sometimes you got to look, and you have to be walked through it.
Yes. Maps, first off, maps not only provide context, they also provide the content.
It's a two-for-one.
And context, this bouncing back and forth between them. But where good maps, I think, are well designed. And so the world of design feathers into this mapping, addressing exactly your point. You can look at a map and can't really figure it out, and you need somebody to stand next to you and tell the story about the map.
Right.
Okay, my theory is there are some kinds of maps that are that way, but good maps, the good mapping requires good design. And I see today with our web technology, this whole generation of neat young people who are embracing mapping, and they love design. So we have open APIs and free software basically for the young developer crowd. They're embracing that and building the They're bringing design discipline into that storytelling in ways that traditional cartographers who were more descriptive in nature didn't do because it was a different medium. This is a new medium, actually. Web maps and web storytelling with quantitative models and lots of mashed up information behind it is a new generation for cartography. And for me, looking back these four decades, This is really about the most exciting time, frankly.
Now, when you get out, just before I let you go, when you get out and you need to go somewhere you've never been before and you pull out your phone, do you pull up a GIS thing that Esri produces, or do you go to Google Maps?
What I do is go to the library and get atlases, old paper maps, and I study them because I like the new story maps that are emerging within our user community.
Well, Mr. Dangermond, thanks very much for your time, sir. I do appreciate it.
Yeah, my great pleasure. Thank you, Kyle.
We'll close with a little teaser of some of the reporting we found in our travels thus far. In Sioux Falls, South Dakota, we met Bhutanese refugees, credit card executives, high-tech tractor developers and engineers. But the woman who stuck with me most of all was Sylvia Henkin. Sylvia moved to South Dakota in 1944. She is considered the grand old dame of Sioux Falls. And besides giving us an incredible overview of that city and its growth and why it's a major player in the global economy, she also told us that in the 1950s, when the city was booming the first time, local officials commissioned a song to tell outsiders about the town. So, of course, we asked her to sing it.
I've traveled throughout this country from north, south, east, and west, and I've come to this conclusion that my hometown is the best. I'm in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. It's the finest city that I know. I love her more every day. Here I'm going to stay, and in the second 100 years, watch her grow. For here in South Dakota, you get more than your quota of friends who would never let you down. I'm from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. It's my hometown.
All right, if you want to hear more singing, more serial journalism, and more about the characters shaping the future of this country's economy, you're going to have to tune into our reporting on Marketplace and check out our American Futures page at marketplace.org. That's the podcast. We're on the radio right after Labor Day for the first report. This, of course, is APM.